Good morning, and welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guest is Scott Crow. Scott Crow is an author, activist, organizer, and revolutionary, maybe, dare I say, a philosopher from Austin, Texas. He's best known for his book, Black Flags and Windmills, and for his work in helping to found the Common Ground Relief Effort in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Common Ground's one of the biggest anarchist projects in the history of the United States. And as far as I know, it was one of the first projects where people, you know, do disaster relief based around mutual aid. And it's a model that people have used again and again. And so this conversation I'm going to have with Scott is basically a lot like conversations I've had with him over the years. Scott is a good friend of mine. He, you know, I consider him a mentor. He's someone who, you know, when I'm frustrated about some shit or I need a perspective from an elder, you know, I usually call Scott, and he really has an incredible view on things. And so this conversation is going to be more based around the kind of conversations we usually have, getting into these sorts of conversations about quote-unquote activism, about quote-unquote community, and how when we engage in revolutionary politics, we can think about what we're doing in different ways. Because even as an anarchist, as someone who thinks outside of the state, there's still that liberalism in your head that you have to kill. When we booked this interview, it was because we were pissed off about the whole fake news, Alex Jones, Antifa, Civil War shit, and how, and just the way information was spreading. And so originally this conversation was just going to be about media. And then after we did this interview, I realized, holy shit, Scott's got a new book coming out called Setting Sights. And this is a book about the history of armed self-defense in the United States. And so he has a huge, huge range of contributors and people who have submitted essays to this book. I'm going to put the link so people can order it on the website. Check it out. And, you know, support Scott Crow's work. Check him out online. He's a fucking brilliant dude and super inspiring and just a really great person. So check out his book, pre-order it, and let us know what you think about this interview. Give us a shout. And this music in the background, this is a Soul and DJ Pain 1 track that we did with Chris from Propagandi, and we actually had Scott Crow do like a spoken word thing at the end of this, so we'll play that at the end. And before we start this interview, let's hear from one of our affiliates in the Channel Zero Podcast Network, and then we'll move on to the interview itself. Thank you.
In the eyes of the government, we are the enemy.
In a world where there is no government, anarchy rules. This summer, get ready for the most action-packed podcast.
We continue fighting because we hate all authority and love freedom, which cannot be given, but must be taken.
Such zines as This Is Not a Dialogue, A Crime Called Freedom, Party's Over, and many, many more.
For more text and audio material of interest to anarchists,
check out ResonanceAudioDistro.org.
Scott Crow, what up, man? Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast.
Hey, man, I'm so glad to be back on here again. I've missed talking to you.
Well, you know, I mean, this interview is a big deal because now you're officially the most interviewed guest on the Soulcast, so.
Holy shit, how am I going to keep that title? I got to hang on to that, man.
You made it, dude.
All right. I like it. Thank you. I'm honored, actually.
Well, thank you for your patience, you know.
Yeah, man.
You've been a guiding light in this void of emptiness and despair.
Thanks. I don't know about that. But you know, the thing is, we just all struggle along in here, right? You know, some of us make different mistakes, and I just made them a long time, longer time ago. You know what I mean? So I had a lot to learn from. Fuck. I bet somebody could find something useful.
Well, so where you are right now? You're in Austin?
I am right now. I'll be here in Mexico. Things are good. Just living the life here, working. We're actually, I'll break the news here. We're actually, my wife and I launched an art gallery called Century Modern. It's not fancy. It sounds way fancier. Let me say it's arts, antiques, and gifts. Just doing what we can to get along in the capitalist system. So we sell vintage art and then contemporary art from regionalists, either Austin or we've been going to a lot in New Mexico. So we've been going back and forth with that, finding regional photographers and painters and stuff, and just representing their stuff for you know, it's not, again, it's not fancy, but we've been doing it for a few years and kind of officially launched the gallery, and it's been kind of nice. So that's been the big, big thing. This is the big break right here. I haven't told anybody about it yet.
I love that. So, like, you're this, you know, closeted antique connoisseur.
Yeah. I know. It's so funny. It's just such a separate world, you know, like to activist world or like revolutionary world. It just seems like to activists, it seems like outside of it. But to me, it's like it's the same. It's like it's just culture. Like, culture is super important. And I think not art as just money, you know, or commerce, but art is important in shaping our ideas and our visions and helping us to articulate those, you know. And so it's just something I've always been in. I've loved beautiful paintings when I see them. I appreciate the technique, the craft. I appreciate where the stories of where they come from sometimes, you know. So anyway, so that's kind of what it is. It is weird, though. It's like they're joining forces now.
That's great. That's great. Well, so you have – when does your new book drop?
I've got a new book. It will actually be out – you can start doing pre-orders on December the 1st. I have a new book out called Setting Sights, Histories, Reflections on Community Armed Self-Defense. It'll be out from PM Press. And I should be dropping a video promotion that explains a little bit about the book and also promos the book next week, actually. And then we'll put out a big blast for people. Next week will be the first week of December. And then we'll put out a big notice for people. And it's beautiful because it's an anthology. It's not just my book. I've worked on this book for about 10 years, but there's so many good voices in it from people who have actually engaged in armed self-defense, you know, like Kathleen Cleaver from the Black Panther Party, Dennis Banks, former co-founder and leader of AIM, American Indian Movement, who just passed 2 weeks ago, and George Chica Rio Mar, who's a big anti-fascist professor at Drexel, who's under fire a lot for his views, and just a lot of voices, a lot of unknown voices, also firsthand accounts from the 20th and 21st century. So yeah, I'll definitely be making lots more announcements about that in the coming weeks.
That's awesome. Did you work on that with Alexander Reed Ross? Is that the one you were working on?
Yeah, actually, Sasha did work on it for a long time. He was when I was in one of my lowest points, and because when you were working on an anthology, it's hard because you have, you know, 36 or 40, 50 contributors that I had to deal with over years and try to get pieces out of them. Some of the people are not writers and stuff. So Alexander Reed Ross was instrumental, and sometimes it was really low about 2 years ago when I was like really ready to drop the book. He really stepped in and said, hey, I can help you edit this thing and pull this stuff together. And he also ended up writing a really good piece for it about Rojava. Nice. and the anarchist work there. And so he was really instrumental. And then in the last about year and a half, Christian Williams worked really intimately with him. And he really, really, really helped shape the book a lot. And I'm really grateful to him. And actually, I work with Christian a lot. I think you know his work as an author, but he's also a master editor also.
Is that the Christian Williams? Did he write the book about like police or something?
Yeah, he wrote I'm sorry, I'm going to blow the title right this second. Sorry, Christian, but it's not the Thin Blue Line. I am so sorry.
Yes.
Our enemies in blue. which is actually a seminal book on policing. If nobody's read it, it's been issued 4 times in 4 revisions because it's been so good. And I think the first one was in 2000, and then he's done other reiterations, including one from AK last year, which is the best one. Because he got to fix a bunch of things and actually add a lot more analysis because Black Lives Matter had been jumping off when he was redoing the book and stuff. And he also did a collection of essays called Fire the Police, all about policing. It's a really, really good collection of essays that came out, I think, about a year ago also. And he's written on torture and stuff. And, you know, he's also done like comic book reviews and stuff. He's one of the few people I know who's a true writer. Who writes all day, all night. Him and Rebecca Solnit.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've been like that book has like come across my feed or whatever so many times. I'm just like, I feel like now I got to read it. Because I mean, a lot of this shit about like, you know, slave patrols and, you know, how policing gets its starts. Like, I think I know it, but I don't think I really do, you know?
You know, he dives in depth, and also he has an anti-authoritarian and anarchist lens that he looks at it through, which is unusual for policing books that are not just like anti-cop or in the more mainstream publication world where they're just like more academic treaties on it or libertarian treaties on it. And he actually approaches it from this anti-authoritarian and anarchist perspective but with a really broad and good analysis, I think. I think it's actually just a really good book. And he's just a really good writer, too. I just appreciate his views a lot.
I mean, this book is super timely, you know, considering, like, you know, 90% of the time when you go out to a protest or something nowadays, there's, like, armed 3%ers and people on the left are getting armed. Like, do you have any thoughts about this current, you know, anti-fascist moment or this Donald Trump moment in light of releasing this book?
I mean, I talk about it in the broader sense is that I have not seen this kind of upheaval in the 30 years I've been involved with activism and politics and social movements over 30 years now. My gosh, I'm getting to be an old guy. you know what I'm saying? But I've never seen as tumultuous of a time as we're having right now. And it's interesting because I don't think it's just the politics of who's in the White House or any particular one issue. I think it's a global upheaval that's kind of been happening. And, you know, it's like even as the U.S. itself has gotten more conservative in some ways, it's also gotten much more liberalized in other ways, you know, like, you know, culturally it's much more liberalized. But then you have these conservative factions of it, the you know, quote unquote conservatives and fascistic factions of it. But, you know, it's the whole global uprising. I think and you know, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in this is in a geopolitical scale is really that we forced all these groups who had existed in all these different ways for thousands of years or hundreds of years in like ethnic minorities or self-groupings, like self-identified groupings. And at some point, we did, you know, like the quote-unquote powers that be, you know, the U.S. mainly and the European governments said, hey, we're going to start redividing the world up through colonialism and all of this stuff and forcing people to be together in these nation states. And what I see is that it's coming home to roost that the artifice of that is actually breaking apart a lot. You see the balkanization of like in the former Soviet Union, where they were all forced together under the broad band of Soviet Union. And now the states broke up into states, and now those states are actually breaking up. Middle East, we're seeing it. South America, we're seeing it. In Asia, we're seeing it. And it's interesting because I think that we've also seen the rise of authoritarianism all worldwide. I mean, like literally, you know, like I just saw a study recently that was showing how far quote unquote right that many governments have gone in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. And there's many more of them. It's like the pendulum swing. So there's all these factors that have kind of been in that have created this kind of crisis that we have. And I think specifically in the U.S., and maybe worldwide, but I live in the U.S. and I can speak to that. That I think that it all you know, like in addition to those pieces, that what's happening, the conflict and separation here, the modern day tribalism, you know, if you want to call it that, that could be happening, you know, where people are self-identifying in these groups, is being fed by the internet. you know, unfiltered internet. And I'm not saying uncensored internet. That's totally different. Unfiltered, where people can go to any world that they want to and stay in that world and not have to look out of it, just like you used to do in your own town or whatever. But now you can find other people who are doing it at the same time. And I think that more radical and more fanatical ideas are being able to be expressed and have resonance where they might have been isolated before. You know, you see them, like if you look at it like a meme, like look at like an idea might have just died on the vine in some hick town, you know, or somewhere like in Texas where, you know, like maybe it was like some racist idea, some group got started, two guys started a group, and then it died because they didn't get in touch with anybody. They couldn't talk to anybody and there wasn't really much going on. Well, now they can find, through that alienation or whatever it is that they're finding, they can find other people around the country who have that same alienation around whatever it is and go to, you know, and join up together. And now they feel like they have resonance. And so I think it's amplifying stuff that is hadn't happened before.
Jesus Christ, Scott, write a book about that. Like, why don't I just write that? I'm going to transcribe that and sell it.
Please. Okay. We'll call it a pamphlet.
Well, I mean, it's funny you say all that stuff about the nation states and shit. I haven't even read the book yet, but I've been like obsessed with do you know Nicholas Carr, The Shallows? Are you familiar with this?
No. I'm such an unread person. I'm terrible.
Well, just find the lecture. I think it'll fuck you up. But basically what he talks about is like how the internet and the smartphone have traveled as an invention, like faster than fire, faster than anything. And like so many other things in our society, we don't fully understand the ramifications of these new disruptive technologies. And like, but with the internet, it's like global all at once. And, you know, and like,
it's true.
Yeah. And so like with,
You go. Well, you know, a small example, I think, like not breaking it down from a geopolitical to if you want to look at a microcosm, is look at the anarchist online communities, right? You had infoshop.org for decades that had a very strict moderation policy on their comments that kind of kept things sort of civil. And then Anarchist News came out, and this is not a slight to them, but they wanted to experiment with the idea of unfiltered comment sections. And so so then everybody can post anything that you want to say, troll culture, whatever, with no challenge to it. Well, see, but then what you started to see was I hate to use the word tribalism because I think that's not a very good word for it, but let me just use that as a placeholder. You started to see people to start to have affinity and started to group within those things and started to begin to go at each other. Even people who ostensibly agreed on things, and it was very minutia, big in the anarchy world, but smaller to the ramifications in the larger world. But I think it is very good illustration. You have like the anarcho-communists fighting against the insurrectionists versus the nihilists versus the primitivists. You know, like these groups might have self-identified and had magazines that they would read, and you know, again, in this isolated way. But now they can duke it out, not debate the merits of this, but just go at each other until it was just because it was disruptive. Where, you know, like I almost, you know, like I personally began to not look at the site as much because of that, because I wasn't getting enough out of the site versus what was happening in the comments. And this is not just my experience. This is something that they've recognized. Even Anarchist News has recognized themselves, the collective that is behind it. And so I thought it really interesting. But to me, it's a microcosm of what it is. This exactly what you explained, this larger thing, this like the technology's traveled so fast, we haven't even figured out what we want to do with it and how how it's changing our communication and rewiring our brains. I'm in, man.
Yeah, well, it's also like the death of nuance. You know, I remember before when, you know, we first started talking, I was like, I'm an anarcho-communist. And you were like, I'm an anarcho-communist. I'm a green anarchist. I'm an insurrectionary anarchist. And it's like, you know, we don't have to be, you know, one thing or the other. Like we, you know, all these, we contain elements of all those things. And some days you might feel more insurrectionary. Some days you might feel more post-left. You know, some days you might just feel some. Today I'm feeling kind of liberal. You know,
and, it's true, right?
Yeah,
true.
And so that like kind of like dogmatic, like this is the only way. You know, every other way is wrong. I mean, it also kind of gets into sort of like, you know, Stalinist kind of shit. Like, oh, I've got it figured out. I'm going to show you the way. Everyone else is wrong. And
well, I think that's a problem with activism in general. Wouldn't you? I think you would agree with that, is that we think we have the answers when we're just really struggling along with a certain set of tools and a certain set of information that other groups aren't. But it's no more or less valid than other groups, possibly. And again, I'm not talking about a straight comparison, like this liberal activist group or this non-liberal activist group, but I'm just saying in general.
You know, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is this term activist, because I know you don't like it. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about why you don't like that term?
Well,
activist, why you don't use it?
Because it puts you in this corner, that puts you in this box that says that you're only going to engage in liberatory ideas and praxis in a certain way, that is largely has a subculture around it that is, I think I've talked about this before, that's largely against everything. And activism has become an ideology instead of a reflexive way of to engage for, I guess, lack of a better term, to make changes and to fuck the system up and change the system. And so really what's happened is that it's become its own subculture. Instead of people living their lives and engaging in activism occasionally or liberatory actions when they need to, you know, much more serious things, activism has become the only quote unquote legitimate way to engage. And I think that it's become an ideology and it's become very limited in that. And I think it also has made many of us others, instead of being like part of larger groups or part of larger things, we just say, I'm in this activist group and everything else is not legitimate.
Somebody the other day was talking about intersectionality. And I was thinking to myself, you know, like that, if we weren't viewing everyone else as like separate from what we're doing, you know, that word wouldn't have to get used so much. And the people who use it the most are the ones who are the least intersectional, you know?
No, that's true, right? Well, it's because it's a specialized language, right? All the language in activism is very hyper-specialized language, just like any religious group or any other subculture, a music subculture or anything, has a very highly specialized language. And then there's in those ecosystems, you have people who profit from that, academics who make their careers off of defining and redefining everything that activists may or may not do, professional organizers who have to name things so they can have their credentials and stuff, or, you know, maintaining their jobs. Again, these are not nefarious. This is just how it all works, you know, because we're social creatures. And, again, it becomes a new kind of tribalism or a new affinity, you know, that may or may not be the most beneficial and may or may not be the best paths forward. You know, I often say these days, you know, like if you're not an activist, then what is it that we are? Because if we're more than consumers, right, which is the other thing that capitalism wants us to be, consumers, and like buy our way out of this, you know, like, I buy better things, buy greener things. And if you're not, you know, if you're not an activist, you know, like I think that opens up a whole and you're not going to vote, then instead of saying that's a negative, like that's the only choices we have. What I'm saying is that there's a ton of paths that we haven't even looked at yet, right, that are beyond those three major categories that we figure out for making social change. And anyway, it's because and the reason I do this is not because I want to kick down activists and activism. It's because what I hope in my dream is that we think about liberation, my personal liberation, your personal liberation, our community-wide liberation, these larger scales of liberation, and a much more, like I think you used the word nuance. I think that's in a much more nuanced and a much deeper way than we have been, that don't entrench us, that actually keep us living in dynamic. Because once we begin to get into anything, once anarchy becomes anarchism, once, you know, once activist ideas become activism, they start to become rigid. They lose their dynamicism to it. And I think that, like, to me, that's a sad day, because it just limits what we can do.
Right. I mean,
I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I do. I definitely do. I mean, it's something that, that I think about a lot. Well, it's so funny because I've been taking this permaculture course, and literally a couple of the people in there, one of them's like a NPR producer, another one is like a real estate agent. None of them are anarchists, but they were all working at Common Ground in New Orleans, you know. And actually, one of the people there discovered permaculture through that. And, you know, 7 years later, after like those bioremediation projects or whatever they were doing down there with permaculture, they came back up here, and now they're in like this permaculture course. And kind of being in that class, being around all these like pretty fucking radical people who, you know, mm-hmm. who would kind of get sneered at in anarchist organizing spaces. And it just really cracked my head open and made me think like, fuck, what am I doing wrong? You know, like everything.
Right. I mean, there's another thing with an activism, because I think, I'll back up. What you're saying, I agree with it completely, because those people didn't have to self-identify as activists to be able to do these things that activists might quote unquote own, permaculture. You didn't have to come through activism school to figure that out. Like, you just figured it out because it made people made sense to it. I agree with that 100%. But the thing is, I think that real estate agent, if they, you know, like, I don't know where they are politically and socially and culturally and all of that stuff. This is speaking to abstracts, but you know, like, they have less binds on them, I think, taking that class than somebody who comes out of an activist subculture does, of like, how I can engage in this, where I can use it. Whereas, like, they might have more open potential to use it in places where it might have larger and deeper impacts. You know, I'm not saying that it makes everybody hunky-dory if you're out of activism. I'm just saying that, like, we can't write people off just because they don't speak the language or fall into that. And, you know, that leads me to this other thing, which is that the toxicity of the subculture. I know that many subcultures are toxic to degrees, because the mirror of self-reflection is very small, right? Like, we often don't look outside of our own group for outside information or for confirmation or for confirmation to challenge confirmation bias. Well, activism is like that, I think, and it's very toxic many times. You know, often people are trying to figure out who they are, like their identity, whether it's, you know, like, I mean, like, not just their political identity, just their identity, where they're coming from, who they are about anything. And we often feel powerless, you know, like, that's why we're banding together to do things. We see these ills in the world and we band together, but we end up turning on each other a lot because the larger powers that be are too far away. You know, are they too abstract? Neoliberalism is an abstract. It's hard to get, you know, how are you going to fight that? Capitalism, or, you know, again, larger things, like it's much more hard. And so I think that we have self-reinforcing subculture and activism that really is often toxic, not all the time, but often can be very toxic, you know, in the form that calls it like call out culture or anonymous comments about people that are personal. And the thing is, it's like, we're all working this out. We're all trying to figure out who we are and what we want and what our desires are and what's the world that we want to live in and be a part of or raise our kids in, if we, you know, like, and so, but I think that there's reinforcements that happen specifically in activism that I would compare very much to very much fundamental religions.
I mean, it's so crazy. I mean, I literally, I don't know, ever since I had a kid, I just have had less time, but it's also like the mental exercises I'm willing to do have just like reduced. And so it's like, before I would have like more patience. But it just feels like with social media now, like, I literally just had to mute every single activist in Denver on Facebook. Like, I just don't see that. And I don't even use Facebook unless I'm, like, there to sell some shit or promote something. But it's like, for the 2 minutes I log into my personal account, it's like, every day I would just see some new 101-ass shit where it's like, oh, I'm figuring this out. I'm right about this. And it's just like all that fucking psychic energy, all that negativity. It's like, what are we doing? You know, we're not, Trump is laughing.
Right, right. But the thing is, like, I mean, we think like, oh, it's so toxic in these subcultures, but they've got it good. You know, the thing is, we know, and it's beautiful that we know, that their subcultures are toxic also, right? I'm not saying it's better or worse, but I think there's things that's different. Like if you look at the subculture of let's just look at the elites that you just named, like Trump and you know, like the whole system of power with a capital P, those who have undue influence that should more than they should. You know, like we know they have a toxic culture, but they don't challenge it. They just call it business as usual. I hope, and I think this is what gives me hope, is that are smart enough and creative enough and willing enough. The good parts about people and activist subculture or any kind of subculture to go, well, these aren't working. We should try to do something about it, or we should change these things, you know? And like, I think that there's a couple of good books that are coming out. This woman, Bergen, who's part of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, she co-wrote a book called Joyful Militancy. And it challenges a lot of the toxic culture, not all of it, a lot of the toxic culture within activism and some anarchist cultures and stuff, and asks us, like, what is it that we want and how do we release our desires? And I thought it's a really good thing because it challenges it. Like, there haven't been a lot of books that have been about that. A lot of books are about building the basics. A lot of books on activism and organizing are about the basics. Like, how do you organize? What's a campaign and all these things. But it's time that that activism in this modern era has grows up again. And not just in age, but in depth of experience and practice and reflection. And so the books like this one, Joyful Militancy from Carla, and there's another one called Guerrillas of Desire by Kevin Van Meter, which also draws illustrations and tries to challenge some of the toxicity that's going on and ask us, you know, like, how do we do that? Because we all come into the movements wounded. Everybody joins a subculture of any kind because they're looking for something. We have these things. And so how can we address those things in an anti-authoritarian or anarchist way or an activism way that is not reinforcing of the toxicity of it? And I don't have the answers to this, but I hope that we begin to ask the question. And I'll tell you the truth. I've been working on a book for the last few years, and the working title was Activism is a Cancer That Cannot Be Cured and Must Be Killed.
Nice.
Nice. But that's not what the book is going to be called, but that was the premise of it, because I don't think that we can reform activism. I think that we need to scrap it, just like anything, any revolutionary movement, and begin to ask ourselves. And I think that some of the post-left stuff has been addressing this for a couple of decades, except that you ended up with a bunch of guys who were so bitter and pushing right. Post-left theory that they were as off-putting as anything, and then much of the post-left subculture became as problematic as anything. God. You agree? You feel me on that?
Oh yeah, man. I mean, it's true, because it's like so much of it. Like, I'll be like, you know, I resonate with a lot of this stuff. Like, I feel a lot of this to be true, but God, like, I don't want to be over there with a bunch of assholes.
No, exactly. And the thing is, I've left largely left activist subcultures about 2 years ago, where I physically stopped going to protests, stopped going to meetings, stopped being on tons of forums and stuff. And I didn't do that because I was I did, you know what, let me say this. I did it to be healthy, because I needed to take a break from hearing that stuff reinforced, the idea that the sky is falling, everything is a level 10 alert, everything. So then you can't, it's hard to suss it out. And, you know, we're on constant alert all the time, and everything, every minor infraction from a friend is as bad as neoliberal politics, or as bad as electoral politics, or as bad as anything. And so I just had to figure that out. And leaving it 2 years ago, I feel so much more healthy about it. You know, I truly, this is really, truly honest. I'll be really honest with you here. It's like, I felt like I left a cult after 30 years. And I felt guilty and shameful for leaving activists, because there's things like activist subculture, not because I left any particular person hanging or any group hanging or anything. It was not that kind of responsibility. But in the larger sense, like, am I quitting or whatever? And I'm like, even that, I had to reassess that and go, like, that's unhealthy, man. That's totally unhealthy, right. You know? But I think that activist subculture is part of reinforcing that.
So this is kind of an aside, but it's picking up on what you were just talking about, because pretty much the only experience I have right now with this is I'm taking this permaculture design course because, you know, gardening has just been this thing that has been good for my mental health. It's economically, it's good for me. You know, I love food. And so like all these things, and I just got really into it. And I know permaculture is just another word for like a bunch, you know, stealing a bunch of native practices and updating it. But you know, all that said, you know, when, like, I didn't know what I was expecting from this permaculture design course. And so the first course, it was like 40 people, you know, spending the weekend at this place, Woodbine, which I'm sure you've been, which is beautiful.
Oh, it's beautiful. I love that place. They're beautiful. Such good stewards of the land too.
Yeah, it's just beautiful up there. And I was like, I don't really want to be doing this like weekend slumber party with a bunch of fucking strangers, you know, but I was like, fuck it, I'll do it. And so like some of the things that we had to do in there, like in the first one, every person in there had to draw out the story of their life and break down with a little group of people that they didn't know and like present the story of their life in a minute with this picture. And so you start by building affinity with a small group, and like I'm in a group with all these people who are shy and not comfortable speaking, and so they're like working through it, and then so I like start to have all this empathy for these people, and then you know and then over through the course of the weekend everybody does this presentation, and like I left that weekend feeling closer to these people who I didn't even know 3 days ago, and knowing more about them than people I'd been in the street with for fucking 10 years or 7 years. And I feel like there's these little things like that where like, this is where quote unquote activism or whatever, it like fails, because it's like, you know, we have a meeting and we have an assembly and everybody gets together and just expects everyone to be able to like figure out how to do a whole bunch of shit. But like, if we're not, we don't really even have a foundation to build on. And the other thing I'd add to that is like, there's also like an entrepreneurial sort of element to a lot of the permaculture stuff where people are afraid to talk about, hey, you know, if you like the people in here, maybe you should consider starting a business with some of these people so that you can start to meet your needs. And like some of it gets into ethical consumerism kind of bullshit. Like, oh, we're going to heal the world by having a fucking, you know, garden bullshit. But
right.
But I don't know. And so it's just like, it's like really, really made me think. And the other thing that they did the last time was we did a session on grief where we had to pair again with people we didn't really know and like talk about like, you know, a really difficult thing that happened in our lives, like that we were grieving over, how we dealt with it, how we worked through it, and what parts of it we hadn't resolved. And again, like doing that shit with strangers is fucking powerful. And like, I mean, I don't really know, but I guess we're talking about all this like emotional stuff, that like, you know, I think it is an important historical moment, especially with all like the living in the Trumposphere. We need to start thinking about this shit. Cause that's, you know, it's like that Cindy Milstein book, Rebellious Morning. Like it's fucking life or death.
It's such a beautiful book, too. Such a beautiful book. I'm glad you mentioned that book. But, you know, like, what you talked about is just a really beautiful thing. And I think that you're drawing the true distinctions that we're talking about, which is that the activism. So what you did was permaculture as a subculture of its own, because it has its whole eco world too. It's not just about growing and stuff. It's all of this stuff about taking care of ourselves and doing all that stuff. Has picked up a lot of good tools in the 30 or 40 years they've been doing it to actually tackle these things that actually, I'm going to use the word holistic, but I don't mean it in a new agey way, but it's much more holistic in its approach to everything. Activism as a subculture attempts to do that around specific goals of social change, of fighting against, of doing these things. And I think that the subculture doesn't do it very well because we don't value the other parts. Like So permaculture at the center of what you're doing is actually the physical growing and like trying to figure out how to grow and stuff. But you, all the ancillary stuff of like, how do we take care of ourselves? What is it? How does it impact communities around me? How does it impact our families? Are part of this holistic thing that move at a much slower pace. Whereas like we often were like, oh my God, we got to shut down Trump. We got to shut down Bush. We got to shut down Obama. We get whatever president or whatever entity, Google or whatever it is that we're going after at that month. We're trying to do this holistic approach in an emergency with an emergency heart, where it's like, it's pumping fast and we're going and we're not giving ourselves time to actually go, well, what are you grieving about? What are you sad about? Or like, I can speak from my own experience, many experiences. I carried post-traumatic stress from doing this stuff for 30 years. You cannot face off with the cops day after day. You cannot be almost killed. You cannot be surveilled. You cannot think that you're being surveilled and just be regular. There's trauma in this. Our hearts get broken all the time. Not even the horrifying bigger things like sexual assault or rape or racism or the things that happen within, or the misogyny or whatever happens within the subculture that's the overt stuff. It's that subtle stuff, the day-to-day, which I think Cindy Milstein addresses in that book pretty well, some of those essays that talk about our day-to-day mourning that we have. This is why I don't think, in the 30 years of doing activism in different forms, both within the system and without the system, I've gone to many of these, many trainings, many workshops like that you just described that were not just permaculture, they were activist centered though. And none of those, I got skill. That's true. But it almost seemed like the information I was getting was like a half-assed copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. You ever seen a copy of a copy and it's like where the words are kind of missing from the page anymore, And so I'm getting some information, but not enough to help me actually deal with these things. And I think if we as activists do not value that in the large scale, that we're going to have the same thing that we have, which is a huge amount of attrition where it's largely politically immature, socially immature, and doesn't build for longer term. And that's, we've talked about this stuff before, but I think that looking at models like the permaculture communities, even if I have disagreements about that and have many critiques of them, there's things that could be looked at or to glean from that, to make activism or activist subculture or anarchist subcultures or whatever it is, much more healthy.
Yeah, I know what you mean by the copy of a copy. Sometimes it just feels like disingenuous or forced or something, like contrived not that worked out.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look at it like consensus, right? Let's just take this particular example. Like we want to use consensus so that groups can share power, so that when you're in a group, we can actually listen to each other and share power so that those of us who talk a lot, might step back and things like that. It's a great idea. But what we've done is we've come up with a set of ideas, developed these set of ideas, 10 rules that we have to do, or whatever, I'm making this up, quote unquote, rules. And we've tried to shove everybody's experiences into that. And you ever notice that consensus doesn't work that well with most groups who have not trained with it a lot? Also, it doesn't give us the power dynamic sharing that we want. It doesn't often help quiet people to become better, to get more space to speak or to feel they are more empowered. And then if you deal with cultures outside of largely white middle-class kids, most people just fucking shake their head and go, what the fuck are you talking about? So instead of trying to reform consensus decision making, I'm saying, is there other collaborative and collective ways that we can hear each other's voices, that we can power share within groups, that we can have meetings where we can actually be living and dynamic without stilted and trying to force our way onto people, where you actually organically and dynamically share, are sharing power and listening. I know some of the answers to these things, but I think that if we don't even ask the questions of it, like what's the problem, that we're going to be stuck. And we are stuck like Chuck.
Yeah. I mean, we experimented with that a little in Denver, where I helped put together these quote unquote autonomous assemblies where, people would get together and, it was like an attempt to sort of like, create new groups and new forms of organizing where like people wouldn't necessarily have to come to consensus. But the problem was there was no, and I didn't want to like start another fucking organization, like, cause I just knew how it was going to end. You know, it's just going to be like, oh, it's going to be the same three people that showed up here the first time to fucking at the end.
But like, also, I mean,
managing
like,
this fucking bullshit ass Facebook page. Like, fuck.
No, exactly. No, it's the truth, right? It's like, we end up, let's just get on Facebook. Let's make it. But the thing is like, we reinvent the wheel over and over and over and over and over again. So like the fact that y'all didn't look to groups who had done it before possibly to see what they had laid out before when they were, you know, because this critique I have, I didn't make that fucking thing up. When I started coming into consensus in 1985, people were already having problems with it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And so like, it's like, and then, you know, like spent the next 20 years trying to reinvent the wheel, like trying to figure out how to make consensus better. And then finally about 10 years ago, I realized thanks to post-left writing, really, that it was like bullshit to fucking try, you know, to like, we need to figure out new ways of communication in that, in those, in group dynamics. I hope I don't sound fucking negative.
I just fucking killing activism.
Good. I mean, I think that's like, I think it's a great moment for all that, you know? I mean, we're,
yeah,
it's a, I feel like continuing to do the same shit over and over again is part of why things are so fractured and hopeless, personally. And not hopeless, but just really challenging right now. So,
well, really, I mean, like the root of this is like, if I just wrap that part up, like, is what I want to say is that, you know, I said activism is cancer, must be killed, but really, that's really what I want. And what my desire is for the politics and engagements of possibilities. And that's really what the that book, when it comes out in a couple of years, will be about, is about why the problems, but like, why, here's ways we might want to think about it differently. And here's ways we might want to engage differently, even if there's unintended outcomes and unintended consequences that we don't have any outlook on, knowing we can't control the future. So, I mean, that's kind of the root of that.
In a struggle for collective liberation. People love that phrase every time I throw it around.
That's right.
Okay, well, one other, I mean, we pretty much touched on this, but I don't know if you had anything to add to this. In the past, you know, I've been like, oh, my community this. My, and then you're always like, yo, man, that ain't a fucking community. and so I guess I would like to hear, you know, your definition of community. Or your critique of the usage of the term, whichever is easier.
Well, less the critique. I think if I explain what I think community means, I don't have to critique it. We'll see. I might say some shitty things about it. I reserve the right. So community, we say community, and that's not really true because we're all fluid individuals. Thing about identity, there's hardly anything that's fixed in our lives. There's gender fluidity, there's ethnic fluid, you know, there's ethnicity, and you know, some form of quote unquote race that we might say are pretty solid. But I'm going to say that most things are pretty fluid as far as what we identify in. And so when you say you're part of a community, what are you saying? And what community is that? Is it an activist community? Is it a hip hop community? Is it a queer culture community? You know, and the thing is, because we are complex social beings, we actually overlap in multiple communities, but we don't see it as such. Some days I might be with, when I was younger and my son was little, I was with a bunch of dads, you know, and I was in that father community with them. That later that day, I could be at a meeting with communists and I'm a political activist. And then still later the next day, I could get up and work with a bunch of anarchists to shut down a barricade or something. And then I'm an anarchist. So there's some fluidity in that. And so I think that when we reduce it down and say like you're for the community or you're part of the community or whatever, we have to ask ourselves what community we're talking about. And I think it's a valid question to ask because the way we will engage will be different than if you don't, if you just say I'm in the community. And so I think in activism and in many of the subcultures that we are part of, people are not very clear about that because community is one of those words that we throw around like water or air. It's just like it's everywhere. And people don't really – it's again, it's not about parsing words or defining like super definitions about stuff. But I think without a basic understanding of what community you're part of, you can't speak for everybody else. And that's what most people use it for, to speak for not just themselves, but for other people. Well, you're doing that to the community. Well, I'm like, which community is that? Or, you know, we're going to go help that community. What community is that? And where it gets us into trouble is that when we begin to speak for others, or we begin to think that we are a community when we're not really a community. Those are two problems with it. We ran into it after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans a lot because activists in general were, you know, as part of this thing called the Common Ground Collective. And we would go into these, what I would call communities, even in a few square blocks, because we saw them as complex layers. You had, you know, like, whereas activists would only see them as a community. It's a community of Black poor people in this particular neighborhood. Let's say it's the neighborhood, the Lower Ninth Ward. Well, that's not true at all. You have, actually, truthfully, you have Chicano and Latino people who also live there. But you have Black civic leaders who could be church leaders or politicians or quote-unquote activists who are mainly – their main thing is showing up at city council to harangue people. And they – that's one community. You may have church groups that are totally separate. You may have gangs and criminal enterprises that are in other communities. This could all – you have mothers and children, you know, I mean, again, there's all these, you have anarchists, you can have, anyway, there's multiple people that can be within a few square blocks. And I think it does a disservice for anybody to go into those communities and see them as a homogenous whole. It does a disservice to them and to us. And so what, like after Katrina, what would happen is that activists, largely white activists, because we were a largely white activist group, would say, when after Katrina, they would say like, all right, you need to listen to the Black people because that's the community and we're listening to the community. And that's true. I want to listen to the communities that are there because there's a bunch of them. But just because they are Black and from New Orleans, did it mean that they had any more or less say than the rest of the people around them? And the only way that we were going to get around that was to, because we would have these, you know, this is just I'm illustrating, but this happens all the time in many places. You'd have one person who would say they were the representative of the quote-unquote the community, you know, like, and they weren't. They had no interaction with all the other people, the street sex workers or the homeless people or the churches or something. They just were trying to position themselves as much as anybody as a gatekeeper to do things. Or you would, you know, so it's really important to look at the nuances and the subtleties of that. When you say community, what do you mean? Because I think you actually mean communities. And all of us just about overlap in multiple communities. You know, you might have people that you like to see films with and that you have a film community, even if you're not only going to film shows, you might just talk about films with that. So I think that's really important. And then for the internal reflection, as far as like whatever subculture you're in, well, when you say the hip hop community, that is far too broad to be one community. That's multiple overlapping hundreds, if not thousands of communities, some geographically based, some ethnically based, some based on race, some based on economics, some based on style of music that they like, some of the, you know, whatever their politics. There's a lot of things just in those communities. I didn't even scratch the surface of all of that. So you can't write about the community. And I think that this is one of those things within activism that gets used as a broadsword against everybody. You know, we use the community in terms of often just trying to push whatever agenda is our thing. And if we're in a community, we must all be in agreement. And that's not necessarily true at all. Many communities don't agree with each other on everything. You know, there may be 10 values or 10 principles that we might have vague affinity to, but we might really only agree on three of those things. And so these are kind of some of the subtleties, I think, that come out of using words like community. And I think that you brought up another one. You were talking about community specifically, but the other one is just the language, like using the word of struggle. Why do we always have to be, why does everything have to be a struggle? It doesn't have to be. We have to have joy. We have to have care. We have to have reflection. And these are things that are just as valid. We have to have grief. We have to have love. These things are just as valid as quote-unquote struggle and movements, you know? You know, as long as we're stuck in the idea of what we're against and we don't ask ourselves what we are for, I think we're going to play these scenarios out again and again around language and around the culture that we have created and that we are part of.
I know, like I realized I'm a well, that's fucking amazing, Scott. First of all, I'm so glad we're talking about this stuff, because I feel like I've benefited so much from this sort of shit on the side. And so it's really cool to sort of do a bird's head, like, I don't know, philosophy sort of interview with you, because you're always either talking about guns or Hurricane Katrina. So it's nice to hear you talk about something different.
No, I know. It's like, I get pigeonholed, man. People are like, yeah, you can only talk about these three things, anti-fascism, guns, or disaster. I'm like, no, actually, there's a lot of other shit. We can talk about culture. I love talking about culture.
The funny thing about community is I was like, as you're thinking, I was like, oh God, I'm a reluctant, self-hating member of the foodie community. God.
Well, that's right. You don't have to join in. So you have one value with them, this one particular piece that you cross over with it. And that's okay, because you're in all these other places that fulfill the complexity of who you are. You know what I mean? And hell, being the foodie community, I mean, good food's a good thing. We all need it. We can't all suffer and sacrifice and struggle and fucking not eat. We're going to die. You know, like not helping anybody, including ourselves, you know?
Yeah, and if I learn about some edible flowers to throw on top of my shit, hey, who's mad at that? You know?
Right.
My guests aren't.
Yeah. Something you said to me a long time ago, I think you're the one who called me a street philosopher one time in passing. Now that I think about it, I was like, oh my God, I think that's true. And I used it on my Facebook page.
Nice. I don't know if that was me. Maybe it was me. I mean,
like in some passing conversation that we had, I was like, oh, my street philosopher? Okay. I'll take it. Fucking untrained, uncouth fucker that I am.
You're pretty couth. Not that I know what the word means. So the original reason we were going to do this interview is because your boy, your hiking buddy, Alex Jones, has, you know, who's like the, you know, whatever, the Pat Robinson of the fake news industrial complex. He, you know, he started this, first of all, you know, creating the fake hoax that Antifa was rising, Antifa Marxists were going to rise up on this day. And then that never happened. And then when that person went and shot up that church in Texas, was really quick to associate that person with Antifa. And it's not the first time they've done it. And so far they've largely failed. But I think they're going to plug their holes in that ship and eventually, you know, perfect their fake news operation to the point where not only does it bubble up, but it's actually believed. So I guess I wanted to just, you know, you're involved with the Agency Group, which is an anarchist an anarchist PR firm, I guess. And so you've been analyzing the way that these fake news articles are picked up, shared, created, and the impact they have. So I wanted to get your thoughts on all that, on the Alex Jones stuff, and all this like real fake news and the threat it poses.
Right, right. And let me be clear about agency. Really what we do, it sounds like PR, it sounds like we're trying to sell things. Really what we're trying to do, agency is a really, really good project that's great for mass communication. And I actually have enjoyed being a part of it, because it's really some parts propaganda, but part of it is sussing out the details of this kind of stuff. And it's ad hoc. Nobody gets paid for this, so we're doing it on our own. But what we try to do is make sure that anarchist voices are represented in mass media, either by especially on particular on really pointed things that are about that the anarchist ideas really overlap in, but broader ideas too, like, you know, anarchists weighed in on same-sex marriage. You know, the Agency wrote some position pieces on that from an anarchist perspective. But then, you know, like the Antifa stuff that came up, because the mass media was slaughtering Antifa and comparing it to neo-Nazis who want to commit genocide on mass populations of people, or exclusion at the least. And so Agency tried to battle that in the public media. And so we try to get, you know, not just op-ed places, but like get people to speak against it. I spoke a bunch because it was actually interesting. A lot of people did not want to speak about it. But we also tried to talk in background to journalists. So I think it's a very, you know, to actually get their heads around it, because they don't give a shit. You know, it's just a media story to them. So at least give them to get their heads around it, so that we could try to shape the media. And we look at long term shaping the media, not like an individual story where you get your talking points down, but where, like, how how does that play across like 15 stories or 30 stories, or how does it play across for a year? And so we make sure we keep up with it and try to keep that going. And again, it's just volunteers and ad hoc, so it's not some big entity with a lot of resources. And so the way that relates to the Alex Jones stuff is that I've been following right-wing fascist media probably since about 1984, 1985. I used to get their papers, and I've always, because, you know, learned from the art of Sun Tzu a long time ago, you know your enemy and know yourself. And so I've always wanted to know what they have had to say. But there's just been interesting thing that's really come out, and really far dangerous thing that's come out about fake news. People like Alex Jones before the internet didn't have much reach, right? He was on cable access and some you know, like really right wing radio, you know, like AM radio stations. He didn't have a very far reach, but the internet has been able to proliferate. Went from a nothing operation on a cable show to $15 million a year doing stuff. But he peddles nothing but fake news. That's the whole entity of the thing, and they're really good at it. InfoWars, that all the different sites that they have, they actually are really good at setting up meme ideas and getting them far reach outside of mass media. So basically, you have two structures now. You have mass media, which is like your CNNs, New York Times, and all the stuff that you know, right? The regular quote unquote media. And then you have this, what we have called alternative media for a long time, which has actually just become the other form of mass media, which is mostly internet based. YouTube, Instagram, Reddit, and a myriad of websites. But, you know, you understand what I'm saying. And so sometimes the reach of those is, and the cultural impact of those, of news coming out in that is as powerful as the New York Times breaking a story. Because they're different kinds of stories. It's not like a mass terrorism or the mass news that you normally get, airplane disasters or whatever the shit that's going on, electoral politics. It's usually something else. And so if these news sites have this proliferate news site, if people like Alex Jones and their fake news, and Alex Jones is a fucking asshole. If I could ever say that, he's a fucking piece of shit asshole. Can you quote me on that?
I just did.
I just want to be clear. He's a lying fucking piece of shit. He just does it for the money. And so, him and that crew have figured out to build this multimedia empire to make a lot of money that is not heard of, but it has incredible influence in these other subcultural ways. So like, if you watch that Antifa story, you didn't see it in mass media. You didn't see it in the big stuff, maybe an occasional story because it's on 24 hour news cycles and people want to write about anything, but barely saw anything. But if you look across like YouTube and Reddit and right wing sites, you would think it was the biggest news, and even gets traction with Fox News to degrees, which would, you know, like, even though they're ideologically in the same corner, there's a huge spectrum between them. And so, you know, that story, that fake news story about November 4th, which was a total lie, it was a total absolute fabrication. Like, there wasn't even a single bit of truth in it. He was talking about super soldiers, like people were taking serums and like going to be like super soldiers of Antifa fighting in the streets, and they were going to behead people and all this. It just took on a life of its own. And I think that a lot of times, because in anarchist subcultures and activist subcultures, so many people don't want to take on the media, especially deal with the mass media, that we don't even think about dealing with that stuff because we have, you know, we're in our insular bubbles, right? We have our websites that we go to that don't have the reach. And even if they do have the reach, they don't have the far, far reach that these conspiratorial sites have. And so we ignore them. We don't engage them. You know, like groups like our ideas or networks like Anonymous never think about taking those kind of sites down. You know, and there's a bunch of them. But you know, they might take down CNN site or something like that. But I think it's far more dangerous because these people are calling for civil war. Alex Jones, in particular, the piece of shit Alex Jones, is calling for civil war. He says we're already in civil war. So it doesn't matter whether people don't show up on those November 4th things because it's not reaching. But the people who it does reach are terrified. I get emails from them. I know they're terrified. And when people are afraid, you cannot talk them out of it. There's no rational decision making that's going to happen. And these people are armed to the teeth. They've been arming themselves for 25 years. The right wing has, with huge support of the National Rifle Association and libertarian movements. And these people aren't just like they have a gun or two. They have multiple guns, and they're afraid that they're either in or headed towards a civil war. So I think that like I talked to a few mass journalists about the November 4th stuff, you know, like behind the record, to give them the background on like why they shouldn't pay attention, how it was the RCP front group. Nobody gives a shit about them. All the things that we know. But nobody did anything to really stop that mass fighting. Like Anonymous did nothing to try to interrupt the flow of information. There was no engagements with anybody that tried to counter that stuff. And so I think that it's something that we should pay attention to, especially if you pay attention to media at all, because and that we should engage in, because we can tell our own stories in media, which is important. But the second thing is that we can countervene and have interventions of stories that are untrue, where people's lives are at stake. And just anecdotally, I mean, I get death threats because I talk a lot in mass media, but I don't take very much weight to them. But when the Alex Jones stuff came out, I got more of those in a different way. And it's kind of, and it scares me, but it didn't, but it scares me in a different way, because I can't, there's no common ground. Even if they're my ideological enemy, there's no common ground that might stop them from taking obscene actions, like people like Dylann Roof, or the driver in Charlottesville, or the that killed Heather Heyer, or the person in Toronto that drove into a crowd and killed people. You know, these people, they are already afraid that they're in a civil war. We're doing nothing to combat it. And I've used mockery. You've used mockery. You did the Fuck Alex Jones song, which was actually really brilliant in a lot of ways, because you actually really uncovered a lot of the real stories of what he was saying. But you were mocking it at the same time, right? But I think that is one way that we need to attack. But there's other ways I think that we need to attack and or defend ourselves, not again in the physical space, but in the internet space. And I wish that people would begin to think about it and actually take it much more seriously than they do.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's funny, because I used to listen to the Alex Jones show. You know, I was like a hair breadth away from being a 9/11 truther a very long time ago. I never was, but
But you know, many people are, though. I mean, I meet so many people, you know. I mean, because he does have real news. That's the hook. He has real news, real information, and then he mixes it in with this other shit.
But then he'd start, you know, like somewhere. I mean, he wasn't always like a fascist to me. Like he at a certain point, he, you know, just started talking about. Once he started talking about Mexican immigrants being pawns of the New World Order, that's where I was like, yo. And I remember, like, when I was about to make that song, I asked other rappers to hop on that track with me. Like, yo, let's who ride on Alex Jones. And motherfuckers didn't want to touch it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was like, it was really before before the Trump shit, where he became official state news, you know? It's
right,
insane.
Right.
It's insane.
But you know, the thing is, I mean, he's on the radio and TV 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, and he promotes and promotes and promotes, and he has a whole ecosystem that just so it makes sense that it's influenced a lot of people, and that it has cachet amongst rappers, you know, that and other culture makers. I meet people all the time who are confused by it, you know, until the more recent stuff, because I think there has been some analysis, but mostly, again, in this dismissive way. And a few articles that have taken them very seriously, but I think that us in that believe in direct action or engage in direct action, and groups that really are fighting different fights should definitely look at these. It's not just him himself. It's all of those kind of sites as points of intervention, as just another way. And you know, again, this is just in the media, the whole and thinking about media sphere. I'm not saying people need to drop whatever projects they're working on to do it, but think about it as an and, you know, because he does. It is confusing, right? It's that's how propaganda works.
And I mean, the fact that
we're calling neo-Nazis alt-right is I mean, that shows you how propaganda works. It works.
And one thing I'll add to that is, like, you know, I've gotten death threats, and, you know, I've had, like, weird little things over the time, over my activist or music career, whatever you want to look at it. But the ones that I've always been the most disturbed by are sort of people with PTSD that are a little that have some that seem like they have some problems, who latch on to these conspiracy theories, you know?
Absolutely.
And when Absolutely. when I get threats from those people, that's when I'm the most like, okay, fuck, how do I fucking, because it's always like some local person. I'm like, all right, how do I negate this? You know? And it's usually it's by empathizing with what they've gone through that led them to have the PTSD that they have and saying they've just got me all wrong. And usually,
right,
usually that works.
But what do you do when there's tens of thousands of them and they're armed because they form the militias? All the people who came out of Iraq and Afghanistan, all the military people who came out of that, the hundreds of thousands of them and the tens of thousands of them, the 10,000 of them have joined militias and are in this fear mode because they listen to him beat the drum of war day in and day out. How do you deal with that? You can't just do it in an individual story anymore. So, and that's it's a big question. And I think that one way to, you know, like one intervention is the use of media and mass communication to talk about this.
You know, maybe it's time for Fuck Alex Jones Part 2.
Damn right it is.
Damn.
Okay. Damn it is.
Okay.
You got so much to update this shit with. Yeah.
And maybe I'll dress up as Donald Trump.
Oh, you know? My God.
But you know, and then like, but in the middle of this conversation, you know, and the way you're framing it is like, holy shit, what, how horrifying is that? Yet the media in the state is criminalizing the left. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy to me that they don't even like make subtle pretenses to act like they give a fuck about that shit.
So they just want to maintain law and order. Crazy. That's all we have to remember. Power wants to maintain law and order where they are at the top. That's all I got to remember. And then I'm like, do we have common interest? Oh, no, not at all. Do we have common interest occasionally? Yes. And then we get together on that and we split on the rest of it.
So pretty much we've covered most of the subjects I wanted to talk about. And I guess in closing, I would like to just, you know, as someone who's been I feel like we're in a period of repression, you know? Mm-hmm. And so as someone who has been a target of FBI surveillance and on the terrorism watch list, you know, I guess in light of like what we're seeing with J20, the criminalization, like this horrifying criminalization of dissent. And I guess I just kind of wanted your thoughts on how, you know, some positive thoughts on like how people can be thinking about this moment in the, you know, through the long lens of repression.
You remember that even as we're facing this repression, one of the things that we're seeing is that, again, we're seeing heavier repression, heavier quote unquote fascism on one side, but on the other side, we're seeing much more radical, much more anarchist, much more liberatory ideas also emerging and praxis emerging at the same time. And I think that we need to celebrate that and continue to nurture that. It's flowers coming up through the concrete. And at first it was just a little flower, and now there's more flowers coming through the concrete. And we just need to keep growing them until we just break up and break up the concrete. And some of the flowers are going to get stomped along the way. But soon those roadways will give way to fields. And that's – if we begin to think in metaphors like that, like what is it that we stop trying to stop everything? We stop resisting everything. We still resist, but we began to create and build. I think it's much more important, because if you want true autonomy and you want true liberation and you want people to stop suffering, you have to build your own power individually and collectively. We have to build our own power. And struggle is not the only way to do that. We need to do it through joy. We need to do it through love. We need to do it through hard things and beautiful things at the same time. And if we do that, if we begin to ask ourselves, what is it we want and how do we want to get there, then we begin to create true communities of resilience that are living, dynamic, and fluid, and that can deal with disasters, whether economic, political, war, or military. We can deal with it. And until we begin to do that, I think we will always be in this cyclical rut of like, how do we stop? How do we stop? And I think that look at what's happening with the J20. When, you know, people say it's historical, but I want to remind people that people have faced charges like this about every 10 or 15 years. We just forget that they do, that hundreds of people. I face felony charges. My bail is $25,000. People face bail where they're facing $200,000 bails, hundreds of us being arrested at the, you know, and this happens over and over again. That's not to minimize it, but what's happening that's more beautiful now is that the word has spread in a much larger way, and there's much larger support on that. Even as the Justice Departments are really the injustice departments are doing what they do, we still need to create power, and the power that we build around resisting that, when we create other things. And that's just an example. I think also what was happening with the pipeline stuff throughout the Native communities is an incredible set of stories and of empowerment of that hasn't happened in a long time. What's been happening in disaster relief, where disasters are now another point of intersection where people can be first responders, but also to help people build communities as they see fit with their own self-determination, not our visions for the future, that these things are openings that are happening around us, and that we need to not just celebrate them, but help them push that crack in history open further.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. It is crazy to think that, getting a $25,000 bail if you're being at a protest, though. I mean, that's...
But it happens. It's far more common than you think. It just hadn't happened in a while because of all the lawsuits that happened that we won. I mean, I've won $50,000 from the police for being arrested incorrectly or beaten. No, and that's not one settlement. That's multiple settlements because people sued D.C., they sued New York, they sued all these things. Not me, but other people. We were part of class action lawsuits to stop them from doing that. And so people didn't think it was going to return, but it does return because repression always returns. And the more that they lose, everything ends in excess. And the more that they lose their grip on society, civil society, the more they're going to try to put a stranglehold on it. That's why the fascism looks like it does now. And I think that, but our resilience is more networked and our resistance is networked, and our resilience is global, that we have far, far reach to get support for each other. And I think that we need to look to that. Again, not in a Pollyanna way, like everything's okay. I'm not saying things are difficult, but there are difficult days and there are beautiful days, and we must enjoy them both for what they are.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing I'll say is just from what I've seen from the J20 organizing is, I mean, the way these defendants are advocating for themselves is so beautiful and powerful. It's very inspiring.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that about does it. We're about at 1:15, so that's a good place to cut it. I was just wondering, I'd like to ask everyone, do you have any books you think people should read right now? Any books you recommend? Doesn't have to be political. Be whatever.
Cindy Milstein's new book is the one I'm reading. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the title of it.
Rebellious Morning.
Rebellious Morning. That is a really... that anthology has been resonating with me a lot. And also I've been reading, I went back and reread recently, Nonviolent Communication, the book on nonviolent communication. And I've been trying to put that praxis more into my life, just on a personal level.
Who wrote that?
My gosh, I forget his name. Robert Rosenberg wrote that probably 30 years ago or something, or 20 years ago. And what else have I read? I got David Van Dusen's new book on anarchism in Vermont. It's a collection of essays that he's written over the last 25 years. He was an anarchist. He was one of the first people to do Black Bloc in the 90s and then helped to really develop the ideas. He wrote the Black Bloc papers that came out probably 15 years ago. And this is a collection of essays. And it's nice to see his progression from anarchist Black Bloc to an adult with children and living in Vermont, and like what does it mean to live autonomously and collectively and stuff. And so he has essays on that.
All right, well, Scott, if people wanna, what's your new book called? And
it's Settings. Oh yeah, go.
No,
Setting Sights: Histories and Reflections on Community Armed Self-Defense, out from PM Press on December 1st. Starts shipping.
And if people want to track you on social media or online or find you, get in touch with you, send you death threats, where's the best place to do it?
You can find me at all the corporate media, social media sites, Facebook and Twitter mostly. Or you can find me at my website, scottcrow.org. And that's crow like the bird, not like the actor, .org.
Awesome. Hey, I really, really appreciate you taking the time today and coming on.
Thank you.
And
I mean, it's always engaging. It's always thoughtful, and I super appreciate it. And I appreciate you having me on. It's validating, and I really appreciate it, man.
Well, ditto, brother. Ditto. I'll see you out there in the Southwest sometime. So
that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a great day, man. Peace.
You too. Peace.
Same people go and raise kids. Not here, where the factories close. All we produce is death. Welcome to the purgatory. Not quite a worker, not fully a slave. Wide open jail, and all your heroes are cops. From today's Andrew Jacksons to tomorrow's Trumps. Nobody really rents, nobody really owns. They wanted a global village, but what's a village to a drone?
We've been enlisted to wipe each other out. They won't be happy till the sky is black. Every forest cleared, every ocean a tomb. This is how it's always been. We've been enlisted to wipe each other out. They won't be happy till the sky is black. Every forest cleared, every ocean a tomb. This is how it's always been.
It's our new reality, isn't it? I mean, we're facing historic crisis from exploitative and destructive economic systems, corrupt governments, and civilization as we know it. They're all causing disasters with many faces, economic, ecological, and war. We will never vote or buy our way out through political systems or corporations. Our time is now to find other paths, to rely on each other instead of them. Our futures are open to resist, rebel, create, and build our dreams on the ashes of theirs.